Juan Sanchez v. State, case number 66964. And so, Mr. Waters, if you're ready to go.
Thank you. Good morning, Justices of the Nevada Supreme Court. My name is William Waters, along with my co-counsel, Kelly Jones, from the Clark County Public Defender's Office. We represent Mr. Juan Sanchez. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Mr. Sanchez, there's two issues in Mr. Sanchez's case of what I would argue is structural error, which would require this court to reverse his conviction. The obvious one is the issue with Batson, and we all know that Batson violation is structural error. I think the more dicey question is whether the judge's failure to refer the recusal motion to another judge would necessarily constitute structural error. I know that the respondents suggest that's not the case, but my suggestion is that it is absolutely the case. If you look at the cases cited, beginning with Libby, which admittedly was overruled on a different by the U.S. Supreme Court on a different ground, and then moving on to Turner, and then ultimately Tobin-Dodge, which was 2005, Tobin-Dodge suggests that the requirement when you're alleging bias of transferring the motion to another judge it's absolute. And then there's other cases which suggest that the judge would lose jurisdiction as soon as that motion is filed. And if you lose jurisdiction, I don't know how a respondent can credibly argue that you can't apply structural error and you can merely apply harmless error to the analysis. Now, in this particular case, I don't think it's disputed. Based on what had happened, there was no opportunity to file the motion pursuant to NRS 1.230 or 1.235, that because this occurred essentially the first day of trial, and just to give you some background, I've been a public defender for 10 years and I've done numerous trials. I had never done a trial in Department 23. Ms. Jones is a relatively new public defender, or was at the time, and although that's the track that she typically appears on, she had never done a trial in there either. So, as you're all aware, district court judges have different ways in which they conduct their trials, and they have different rules, and that's fine. They're entitled to do that. But I think attorneys who don't generally practice in certain departments are not going to be aware of those. So when the incidents happened, and I do want to point out, because I know that Judge Miley took great pains to suggest when she was making this record, which I believe she didn't really have the authority to make, that, well, there's no bias here. I don't know anything about you. I don't dislike you. I don't like you, whatever. The point that she kept missing was that I believe under the canons, Rule 2.3 A and B, her bailiff's conduct is attributable to her, and she's responsible for ensuring that her bailiff doesn't act in the manner in which he acted. And so,
Mr. Waters, since you mentioned the bailiff, is the bailiff going to make any rulings in the court?
He's not, Your Honor.
Well, that, if he is biased, he can dislike you all day. Is that going to affect the outcome of the trial?
Well, I do think
Will it affect the outcome of the trial?
Potentially, and here's why.
Will the bailiff make substantive rulings on issues of law?
No, but someone with a less thick skin might fear his fear.
Mr. Waters, did the bailiff do anything in front of the jury that would diminish your ability to represent your client?
No, the jury didn't see any of his behavior. But, Your Honor, now remember that one of the comments to the rules does suggest facial expressions and so forth can also convey bias, which isn't going to be captured.
Again, counsel, as I ask you, was this done in front of the jury? And your answer was no.
But, and Your Honor, respectfully, I don't think that's the issue here. Because there's nothing in the rules that says that that bias has to occur in front of the jury in order for your client's fair trial rights to be violated. It says
when it involves a bailiff?
Because the bailiff's behavior is attributable to the judge. And let me pose this for you, Your Honor. A judge couldn't do the things to me that the bailiff did in that trial. She couldn't. And I think we would all agree that under the rules that would be absolutely prohibited. She can't tell me, and I don't want to use profanity, but she can't say the things to me that this man said to me when I was merely trying to do my job. And with all due respect, we have access to those back hallways. This is an issue that the court administration allowed the public defenders to have access to those back hallways specifically for situations like this. So when you're on trial, you don't have to sit in front of the door, the locked door with a veneer, while you know, the state, who did have access to the back hallways from the day this building was finished, could come and go as they pleased and prepare for trial. Meanwhile, we're stuck outside and we can't converse with our client who's in custody. So So I did nothing wrong, and quite frankly, like, his conduct was outrageous. Now, the judge is responsible for his conduct. So a judge can allow him to act that way and then say, well, I'm not, you know, give this guy free rein to act the way in which he acted, but yet you can't stick that on me. That's not my responsibility. I'm not responsible for the way he acted. He doesn't like you, great.
All due respect, counsel, it sounds like sour grapes to me. Give me some legal authority that says this affected your client's trial rights, that this affected your ability to conduct the trial in the manner that you chose to do so. I mean, we got to have something more than I don't like that you kept me out of the back hall.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I disagree with you that that's...
Give me some...
The point is, if I can allege facts, which I did, which would cause a person to reasonably believe that there was a bias from that judge, okay, and if you look at the other canons, since she's responsible for his behavior, the buck stops with her, that's what I need to do. That's what I need to do. I don't need to point out to whether the jury saw these things or not. So,
what if we disagree with your assessment of reasonableness? What if, on its face, a person were to say, this motion is a complete non-starter? Do you still maintain that the trial judge rejecting it on herself rather than referring it elsewhere constitutes structural error?
Well, and I hate to answer the question with a question, but how do we know it's nonsense at that point?
Well, just wait a moment. Please don't answer it with a question. Let's assume that on its face it was deemed to be not a reasonable challenge. Would it be structural error for the judge to reject it as such?
Well, you mean this court deems it on its face not a reasonable challenge?
Yes.
Okay. Well, the problem I have with that, though, is that the record wasn't developed sufficiently in the district court.
I understand you don't. You would not like to credit that it. You don't want to accept that it's an unreasonable complaint against the judge. But just bear with me and indulge my assumption. If we were to say we've looked at this, we think this was not a reasonably founded basis for disqualification, would you agree with me that the sitting judge against whom that is directed can reject it and go ahead with the trial?
I don't think so, because for two reasons. One, I don't think the judge whose court staff is being accused of the things that this man was being accused of is in the best position to be unbiased in their response to the allegations. And I think that's why it's hugely important that some...
So anytime a lawyer wants a timeout in a trial, they can just say, here's a complaint, I'd like you to get off the case, Judge, and then we have to stop the whole proceeding? Is that the...
Respectfully, though, I don't think that this doesn't happen very often.
No, I understand. But I
don't think that this would open the floodgates to that happening. And quite frankly, the implication that I did this for some, like,
I'm not implying it at all. I'm testing the...
I mean, what does Baylor...
I'm trying to test the boundaries of your argument and what, if credited, it would mean.
I just want you to answer Justice Pickering's question. Consider it a hypothetical. Then can you answer it? That's all I think we're looking for.
But again, I don't think the record is adequate at this point for this court, respectfully, to look at it and say, well, these are just unfounded accusations. How? I made the allegations. The judge said, well, this isn't true. And she said this about a person that is so close to her, he's essentially her bodyguard and walks her to the car after work. So when in the world is she ever going to say he did something wrong? That's never going to happen.
Mr. Myers, could I change direction just in the interest of time? Because I know we're almost at your 5 minutes. Okay, you raised the Batson issue regarding jurors Reed and Oliveira and veneer members and their preemption. Can you get into that and discuss it in context of our recent Batson jurisprudence this court's issued and why you feel that's structural error?
Well, you had three African-American women that were on the 24, I think, that were initially qualified. The state used one for-cause challenge and the two preempts on the remaining two. So they used it's a significant percentage of the remaining preempts to strike the only two African-American women that were left. And the reasons given were so vague, untestable. One was that she lacks motivation, which was, I don't understand that argument when all the poor woman said was, well, I never took art class. I guess I lacked motivation to pursue a career as an artist. And I don't see the nexus between that means that she's not motivated to serve on a jury. I just don't see it. And quite frankly, if Ms. Heap had an issue with that response, she certainly could have probed that more. And you look at the cases which suggest that, you know, the failure to question on these issues that you're feigning interest in is evidence of pretext. And then with respect to Ms. Reed, Ms. Heap didn't ask Ms. Reed a single question. So now all we have is a record where Ms. Heap says, well, I didn't like the tone of her voice. I think I'm going to my rebuttal, but I want to finish this. I don't like the tone of her voice. Now, I mean, I can send jabs to this court so Your Honors can look at it yourselves and see if the tone of her voice was such that, you know, that was a legitimate reason to strike her. But the reality is when you justify it for those reasons, how do I counter that? I tried. I said I didn't recognize that. I didn't recognize anything in her tone of voice. She was soft-spoken. I'll grant you that. But when the court pressed her on certain questions, she did indicate, yes, I can be fair and impartial, and the court acknowledged that. So these reasons are so fantastical and so, I guess, vague. And when you look at the reasons given versus the record that, quite frankly, that Ms. Heap developed that would support those allegations, it's just not there. And because it's a significant portion of their preempts were used on the remaining African-American members of the veneer, that the reasons were fantastic, they didn't make a lot of sense, they were vague, and then when you consider that she didn't follow up when she had an opportunity to do so, I don't know how in the world, especially in light of the recent Batson opinions from this court, I don't know how this was not a Batson violation. And I understand Batson is problematic. It's certainly, honestly, it's led me to believe that maybe the whole idea of preemption needs to be thrown out because I...
Yeah, that's the line that's interesting to me is whether we really, Breyer and Marshall have it right that, because we're crossing over into the prerogative as a civil litigator, you would preempt people on very subjective grounds. So you right. start interrogating someone as to the reasons. They are hard to articulate. And this is a different area.
I never thought I would think this, Your Honor, but honestly, I'm beginning to think that maybe preempts are just a horrible idea, because here's why. No one likes to, I mean, certainly I don't think district attorneys like to be accused of being racist, and I don't like calling them racist, but that kind of, that's where we're at with Batson. And
subconsciously, I mean, that's...
Right, yeah, exactly. And honestly, on a very personal level, and maybe to editorialize a bit, with all the recent incidents with the Black Lives Matter movement and Ferguson and so forth, I mean, I had never thought about some of these things, about implicit bias and so forth. And I don't mean to disparage Ms. Heap, and I certainly am not calling her a racist. I would never do that. But I can't be confident that implicit bias doesn't exist in her. It exists in me, and I'm a public defender, and I hate to admit that, but I think that we're all guilty of that at times. And the reviewing court then has to get into the minutiae over, well, what is this, what is that, and the prosecutors come up with, as long as it's any facially valid reason whatsoever, you know, the suggestion that it stops there.
But that's trying to harmonize with the retention of peremptory challenges, which are inherently subjective. I mean, that's the...
Right. And I agree, Your Honor. And I'm not, you know, look, far be it from me, I don't have the power to change anything. I'm just saying on a personal level, when I'm litigating Batson issues, I just wonder to myself, like, if this would just be easier. Because quite frankly, I don't think there's any doubt whatsoever that had the state not had the ability to preempt Ms. Oliveira and Ms. Reed, those two women would sit on the jury, because nothing they said indicated that they could not be fair and impartial. So I have about a minute 30 yet left. I'd like to reserve that. So unless there's any other questions, I'll thank you.
We'll add a minute to your time, Mr. Waters. You'll have 2 minutes, 35 seconds. Ms. Heap, you ready to go?
Yes, thank you.
All right.
Good morning, Justices. Thank you. My name is Hillary Heap. I do represent the respondent in this matter, and I was also trial counsel during this trial.
And that makes my question easy. Just tell us why you preempted Ms. Reed and Ms. Oliver.
Certainly. Tell
us why.
Well, first off, I'd like to say there is no record as to anyone's race in this case. And if you do look at the record, and I'll start with Ms. Reed, I didn't know that she was African-American. And quite frankly, even today, we don't know that she was African-American. There is no record below. I would note, looking at the second volume of Appellant's Appendix at 310 and 313, that the state was not aware. I didn't know. So I don't think we can make that leap that I'm somehow striking her because of her race if I wasn't even aware of this.
Counsel, what was your reason for striking the jurors?
My reason for striking that juror is because when she discussed her prior accusation of theft, she had been accused of theft, and when she discussed that, it was my belief that she had hostility still in her voice.
Didn't you leave on a juror who had been pardoned for their theft?
Well, that's referring to Mr. Kitnick, and yes, there was actual... There were
two or three others that also had theft situations.
Well, what was brought up was Mr. Kitnick first. He had been accused 40 years prior of a drug possession charge. He went on over and over again to talk about how he was treated fairly, how he respected the law. He made one statement that said even if he breaks the law today, even if he doesn't agree with that law, he should still be held accountable because we have our laws for a reason.
But he really wanted to serve on this jury.
He was just very forthcoming. There was nothing in the...
But he really wanted to serve on the jury.
And that may be. But I didn't hear anything in his voice to show that he harbored hostility to law enforcement. And if I do hear that as a representative of the state, and especially in this case, all of the witnesses are law enforcement, so that is going to give me some concern. And that's something that I don't think would be appropriate. It would be too risky to keep a person...
But didn't Ms. Reed say she could be fair and impartial?
She did say that.
So no. What more do you want from a juror?
Well, I do think that the tone of voice or someone's body language during the questioning is relevant. Just like when Mr. Waters talks about the tone of, he brings up the tone of the court's voice. That's relevant. You can't hear that in the record. You can't see that written down. And that is what I detected. But back to the issue is I didn't know that Ms. Reed was African American, and we still don't know that today. There's no record of that. So when we're looking at, there was another juror that was brought out, Ms. Henry. I would note nobody discussed that below. When looking back through my notes, because this isn't in the record, but when I looked back through my notes, as well as reviewed the transcript, I noted that her husband was a federal cop, and he was in the Air Force. Generally, that is someone that is going to be a little bit more friendly to law enforcement and someone the state would want on their jury. He also brings up Mr. Zucroff about claiming he had an attitude and an unpleasant experience. Well, that was belied by the record. When Mr. Zucroff was discussing his prior jury experience, he wasn't saying he had a bad time. He was actually saying that he was frustrated with the other jurors who did not follow the law. So from a state's perspective, we want jury members who are going to follow the law. They're going to do as instructed.
Did Ms. Reed say she would not follow the law?
No, she did not say that. She did not say that.
Ms. Heap, what is the discussion about juror Olivera 662? What was your...
Yes, Your Honor.
Thinking there.
Yes, Your Honor. As we all know, jury selection is an art. It's not a science, and I would submit that probably everyone here is much more experienced. So when I have a juror like Ms. Olivera, she presented as very young, maybe out of high school. She didn't give a lot of answers. So when I stood up to question her, I didn't have a lot to go on, so I started discussing her hobbies. And she indicated that the only thing she did was she worked as a cashier somewhere, and she liked to do art. So I asked her a few questions, and she straight said that she lacked motivation to follow through with her hobbies. If she's lacking motivation, to me, I don't see that as someone...
Counsel, getting up and going to work every day, is that not motivation?
No, that is motivation.
She held a job for, I think, the record's 2 or 3 years. So I'm hard-pressed because no real follow-up questions were asked. You asked those limited questions, you cut it off very, very curtly. You had another juror you talked to that read HVAC readings, but he didn't say really why or anything else as to air conditioning and heating material. But he seemed to be motivated, I guess.
And, Your Honor, you're referring to juror Mr. Rodriguez. When he was asked the questions, that was his business. He was a contractor manager. He reads up on his interest in HVAC. He also stated he joined a bowling league. He was in a softball league. He did other things. He didn't just say, when I asked him a question, oh, I lack motivation to do that.
I guess the critical issue for us is exercising preempts, as you said. It's not a science. It's kind of a gut feeling. But looking at these individuals and their responses, we're hard-pressed to see where you would incur that they could not be fair and impartial based upon the responses to the questioning of the court. And in one case, the questioning by the state.
I understand, Your Honor. However, the issue here is were they struck based on their race, and I think part of the problem that we have today is, as I stand before you, I don't have any indication that Ms. Reed was African-American.
How about gender?
I'm sorry?
Gender.
Well, obviously we can tell gender most of the time. However, I don't believe that issue was raised or is before the court today. I mean, we're here based on the claim by defense or by appellant that these jurors were struck based on race, and there's no record of what their race was.
There's another concern as to Ms. Reed because she indicated her business was massage, and the DA has struck a number of jurors previously because they were involved in the massage business.
I appreciate your point that the record is unclear about Ms. Reed's race, but the record is clear about Ms. Oliveira's race, is it not?
It's not. There was no record made of anyone's race. With Ms. Oliveira, she outwardly appeared to be African American. However, that's not something we can assume. And for an example, we have a deputy in our office that looks as Caucasian as I do, and if you were to ask him, he would inform you that his father is African American.
Mm-hmm.
And that same DA is often confused with another deputy who's Irish. So you can't tell what someone is without actually inquiring. That juror, Ms. Oliveira, who appeared outwardly to be African American, she could have been Indian, she could have been something else, she could have been Irish, and we don't know, and there was no record.
Counsel, when Mr. Waters made the Batson objection after your peremptory challenges, wasn't the race issue discussed with the judge at that point in time as part of that three-step analysis that this court's mandated that we go through in doing the Batson test?
Yes, Your Honor, and I did state on the record, both when the issue was raised as well as when we were giving our reasons developing the record further, that I did not, I was not aware that Ms. Reed was African American, and the court even noted that it's hard to tell, and you can't.
The court noted specifically, well, I think that since we didn't go through and ask them their race, I think they're the only two that seem to be visibly African American. That's what the court stated in the transcript.
Right, and that's not that they are, and to me, I didn't visibly see that Ms. Reed was. That's, you know, part of the issue here. The only person that I saw, you can see that when the issue was first raised, the only person I saw that, you know, outwardly appeared to be African American was Ms. Oliveira.
But the bottom line was the 12 jurors were white.
No, they were not, Your Honor.
So what was the makeup of the jury?
There were lots of different ethnicities on the jury, and the court even noted that. There were different Latino and Hispanic sounding names. There were people who appeared to be white. There were Asian people on the jury or Asian people who had Asian sounding names. And that's part of the problem too, is there's no record made of what those jurors were either. So in the same respect, we can't stand here and say what they were.
But there were no African Americans on the jury.
Not on this panel. The only other African American who appeared outwardly to me to be African American was Ms. King Collins. And she said from the very beginning, from the first time she spoke, and I would point you to the second volume of Appellant's Index at 214 and 15, she said she could not be fair to both sides. She was biased against the state. She had a prior husband. Her ex-husband had been a cop, and he had treated her unfairly. She didn't believe the police would support her. So right from the beginning, she said she could not be fair. So there were no other people that could have been African-American.
When you go through your training at the DA's office, what do they tell you about Batson? I mean, I practiced for 28 years and saw constantly of challenges, trumpetory challenges to African-Americans, where a lot of times the only person that was African-American in the courtroom was my client. When you're training, why take a chance on a case? I mean, you know it's structural error. Why'd you take a chance on this?
Well, part of it is it's not taking a chance, respectfully, Your Honor.
I think that next time you pick a jury, you're going to be thinking about what Cherry said, what Douglas said, what Gibbons said, what Pickering was saying, and you're going to maybe be more conscious. But I don't understand why you would roll the dice at the beginning of a case like this to knock off what appears to be three African Americans, the only African Americans on the jury.
Well, Your Honor, and I would say the state's entitled to a fair trial as well.
Well, they get a fair trial with black people, too.
Understood, but if there's a reason that the state believes that that this juror would not be appropriate, the state should be able to exercise that challenge in the case of Ms. King's
But what do you want these jurors to say? I mean, they said they could be fair and impartial. You know, they didn't say anything that would be negative. I don't understand where the negativity comes in that somebody doesn't have motivation. I've never heard that in my years in the 45 years of practicing law here. Never heard it about motivation.
Well, I've never heard it either because no one's ever...
The person came into the jury, came into jury selection and then came to the courtroom.
Understood. There's also an admonishment on the jury summons that says you could be prosecuted for not showing up. In this case, this specific juror stated she lacked motivation. That is not something you hear very often, so it is alarming when someone does say that.
But your question wasn't directed toward would she pay attention in this trial, would she be fair and impartial? That was merely as to this reading, this hobby of drawing. So this stretch that you seem to be making as to she's never motivated, this is not someone who's on welfare sitting at home or anything else. This is somebody who gets up every day, goes to work, and takes care of their mom. If they're not motivated or don't want to pursue their drawing hobby, so be it. Everyone doesn't pursue everything.
And that is correct, Your Honor. She did say that she went to work. However, I did deem her to, she appeared to be young to me. She looked young. She said she lacked motivation, and that shows immaturity. And there is, pursuant to King v. State, it has been held that excluding a juror due to youth and inexperience is not a pretext in this. And the other point I would like to make, in Connor, as well as Hawkins, it's a defense, they have a heavy burden to prove that the explanation is not pretextual. And in this case, Judge Miley, she did give the defense or the appellant an opportunity to discuss any pretext issues, and all counsel stated was, it's merely a pretext. In his brief, he goes on to discuss certain embedded stereotypes as well as...
Well, what he said in his brief and what's in the transcript that we painstakingly read seem to be different. And we are centering on what's in the record and the transcript in terms of the dialogue back and forth between the court and counsel and the various prospective jurors. And that's what we are concerned with this day.
And I understand that. And because that is different, appellant is asking you to find that the court erred below based on reasons that they didn't provide the court an opportunity to even rule on at this point. So given that the three steps of Batson, the third step is highly deferential. The court has the opportunity, which this court does not, to actually see and hear in the tone of voice the different answers and what's going on, as well as counsel's tone of voice, both parties. And in this case, Judge Miley had an opportunity to review all that. And this is a judge who is very experienced in criminal trials. This is not a judge who shies away from any of these issues. She had an opportunity to consider all of those things, and in this case, she denied the challenge. And what I would say is that this court should be highly deferential to those because she did have the opportunity to hear everything. She indicated that what she saw and heard during this time was what the state represented.
And isn't it the case that on a for-cause challenge, a juror's insistence that he or she can be fair and impartial is enough, or ordinarily would be enough to defeat a for-cause challenge? But in the peremptory challenge arena, a declaration like that, a lawyer may disbelieve it and say, you know, the body language was all wrong. I'm not a fan of peremptory challenges because of all the trouble they're visiting on everyone but in this arena, but it seems to me if this is the law, then the question isn't exactly fair and impartial.
And that's exactly right, as it was in this case. It wasn't based off what she said, it was based off how she said it. And the court was there to hear it. It was the tone of her voice. And it wasn't in everything she said. It was specifically when she was just discussing this prior theft conviction. And what that says to me is either she still harbored hostility because she was wrongly accused, or she was rightly accused and she wasn't taking responsibility. Either way, that is not someone the state would feel is appropriate to sit on a jury where all of the witnesses in the case are law enforcement. That shows hostility.
You were arrested on your jury. You left them all on.
Would you like me to answer?
Yeah, you got time.
Okay. There was one other juror. The other jurors, as my understanding, they hadn't been arrested or they hadn't been ever accused of a crime. There were two other jurors, Mr. Kitnick, that we talked about, and he went out of his way to discuss how he was treated fairly and how he believed that he should be charged if he had broken a law. As far as Ms. Henry goes, that wasn't raised below, so there's no record below. But like I said, when I did look at my notes indicated that she, her husband was a federal law enforcement agent. He was in the...
Are you arguing outside the record?
No, this is in the record as well.
Okay.
It's in the record as far as her questioning. What's not in the record is there were no reasons put on because that wasn't raised below as to that.
Okay.
Ms. Heath, there's been a lot of time in your argument devoted to the Batson question, but I'd like to turn to the issue of the motion to disqualify. the first question I have, is it the case that counsel are permitted to wander behind the bench in that hallway between the courtroom and the justice, the judge's chambers? And is it a practice that DAs get to do so but others don't?
No, that's not the case. Both the public defenders as well as the state are badges to get into the back hallway. They do work. This particular court does not allow anyone to have access to the back hallway. When this trial started, as well as every day, anyone who's ever gone into that courtroom, they know that this bailiff does not let anyone in the back hallway. And when this trial started, we were both sides were informed, you can't access the back hallway. This this bailiff does not permit anyone near his or his judge's chambers. And that was made clear to both sides. So while our cards do work and while other judges don't oppose that, while other judges let both parties go into the back or go enter the courtroom from the back, this particular judge does not. And that was made very clear to both parties prior to the trial starting.
And then on the legal question, if a lawyer has concerns that a judge has been biased or a member of the judge's staff has been biased, what's your position about the disposition of that motion by the trial judge themselves as opposed to the reference of that motion to another judge?
Well, I do think the law is slightly ambiguous because the cases that were discussed in both briefs basically deal with enumerated biases. Those, for example, in Turner, that attorney had represented, that stated right there. So the question really is, how do we determine bias? And in this case, in Tobin, it does say that the court or the judge must transfer to another judge. But Libby says that not doing that is harmless. And in Libby, there was actually an enumerated bias. The judge, or it was not an enumerated bias. The judge had made a comment, and this court determined that that comment wasn't a basis, and it was a harmless error for not transferring it. And that's the same here, thing here. In this case, the state would submit that the affidavit and the motion did not set forth facts and reasons sufficient to cause a reasonable person to question the impartiality. Counsel came in, he was given certain rules to follow, he came in, he created issues, and then stood up and said, you're biased because you're enforcing the rules, as you stated in the beginning.
I'm sorry for interrupting you, but on the legal question, on the law, doesn't it appear that the declaration in Tobin is contrary to a harmless error analysis in Libby?
The declaration in Tobin?
That another judge must determine that question, because at the end of the day, the judge might be a witness in that bias question, right?
Understood. And if there was an actual bias, if the court stood up and said, yes, Mr. Waters, I have a bias against you, and then that wasn't transferred, I think that would be reversible. But here it's just the question of whether another judge needs to determine that. And the state would submit that it's probably best practice to do that. However, in this case, it is a factual basis. Here in this case, there were no reason sufficient to even transfer it to a new judge because these were claims that were just outrageous on their face. There was nothing on the face of this motion that needed to be transferred.
Mm-hmm. But when you say best practice, are you saying error but harmless?
Correct.
So a judge against whom bias is alleged should, in your view, get to adjudicate that question?
Well, it depends on how the bias is alleged. If it's a bias alleged that sets forth facts and reasons that would be sufficient for an outside person or a reasonable person to question the impartiality, then yes. But in this case, that wasn't done. Okay. So even if a judge had transferred it, or Judge Miley had transferred it and another judge looked at it, it would be harmless because the any other judge would see that these were actual issues that counsel created on his own.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Heap.
As you approach it, I'd like you to, no, sorry, this counsel, I'd like you to address exactly where the state left off, and that is provide for us, or refresh our recollection, if you will, the enumerated basis of bias that you set forth in your motion to disqualify.
Okay. So, obviously I went based on the canons because of the time problem, but if you look at the 1.230 subsection 1, it says a judge can't act if there's actual bias. Now, that would presume that the judge is going to be honest and say, look, I just don't like this guy, or whatever. Then subsection 2 talks about implied biases.
Okay, I get that, and in light of time, I'm asking you very simply, what were the enumerated basis of the biases that you set forth in your motion to disqualify?
Okay, that the bailiff, who the judge is responsible for, threatened to arrest me for the outrageous offense, Your Honor, and quite frankly, let me finish, the outrageous offense of trying to litigate for my client. We have access to those hallways. This suggestion that defense attorneys are somehow going to wander the back hallways, I mean, we're always looked on with suspicion by, like, court staff and the DA's office. This is ridiculous.
Martial conduct is number one basis. What's
like threatening behavior by the bailiff, telling me to myself, go wait outside, you'll get in this court.
So martial behavior.
Martial behavior. And judicial behavior towards me when I was merely trying to get clarification about the court procedures. Now, this idea that like we're given a list of like this is the way things happen in this court did not happen, okay? Judge took the bench. She said, are there any issues outside the presence of the jury? And then immediately brought in the jury. There was no like, by the way, welcome to Department 23. These are the things that I require of you. These are the things I don't require of you, and so forth. So when I asked, please don't refer to us as public defenders, because the sad fact of life for a public defender is that people don't take you very seriously, including your clients. And we are constantly working to counter the negative perception that we have amongst the staff of the courtroom.
Did she reject that request?
She did not reject that request, but her glib answer that it never happens, with all due respect, the reason why I asked is because obviously it happens. And quite frankly,
in that courtroom?
I'm sorry?
Did it happen in that courtroom?
In my previous experience, that was the first trial I'd done in there.
Did it happen at all?
Well, no, because I made it a record of that before we started to ensure that it wouldn't happen. I just don't like to voir dire on it.
So that's not a bias that you alleged with her?
Well, her attitude towards me, if you look at the canons and if you look at the comments, it does
talk. The same thing that the state is alleging with respect to the peremptory challenges, and that was their assessment of attitude, correct?
That is, but these are different things, though. And I see what you're saying. And yes, to a certain extent, I'm not going to deny that. Yes, it's based on things that aren't captured in the paper record. Absolutely. There's a couple more things I wanted to get to.
You know, I had a question. One thing concerned me that was in your motion to disqualify. You indicated that she threatened you with contempt in front of the jury. Now, is that what happened?
Honestly, Your Honor, I did not have a transcript after that first day. When I got back to the office, I was trying very hard to remember everything that happened at the bench. And I did put that in my motion. She does record bench conferences, so I don't think it showed up in the record. But that was not, I was not being dishonest. It's just I didn't have a paper record to look at and recite word for word what was said at the bench. I was trying very hard to remember, and this is a dynamic process, and my mind's full of a million different things, and I thought that that's what I had heard. But obviously, I think that the transcript, now that they've been prepared after trial, shows that that's not necessarily the case. But again, you know, this happened overnight. And obviously, if I had the transcript, if we had dailies, I wouldn't have put that in the affidavit. I was trying my very best to remember exactly what happened. And I think if you look at my affidavit, I even put in a footnote that I was unsure about the specific obscenity that the bailiff used towards me, because I didn't want to use the F word if that's not exactly what he said, and I thought I had heard it, but I wasn't entirely sure. I mean, I'm on trial. I take trial very seriously, Judge, and this was like extraneous nonsense that I shouldn't have had to deal with. And it suggests that I know
answer my question.
Okay, I know people don't necessarily like me, but that doesn't matter, quite frankly. That bailiff could not like me. I don't care. This isn't a popularity contest as far as I'm concerned. You know, I have an obligation to my client. And as I alluded to, we have biases and prejudices against public defenders that we fight against every day. We're public pretenders. You're dump truck. Your clients hate you sometimes when you're in trial. If I walk into court assertive, confident, and some bailiff perceives that as arrogance, I can't worry about that, okay? I'm trying to show my client that I'm going to do everything for him, and I'm going to stand up for him in the face of a bailiff who's threatening to throw me in jail and a judge who's, like, rolling her eyes at me because she thinks my simple requests are ridiculous. And I'm sorry I got a little worked up, but I've been doing this for 10 years, and I'm passionate about this. And I hope that...
Well, I've heard it my whole life. My uncle was the public defender in Washoe County for about 25 years, so I'm familiar with at least that far back ago.
Okay. You wanted to make two points, and I'll give you 1 minute to make both. So if you could just hit it, and let's move.
Okay. Ms. Heath does... I'll concede she makes a good point. Those three jurors were African-American, no doubt about it. Yes... Her point that, well, how do we ideally know? I don't know. We don't take DNA tests on the jurors when they walk in. But then maybe that's the problem with Batson and the progeny and the idea of preempts, is that you can never 100% know what the genetic makeup is of a particular individual. But I don't think that this was clear that these three were African-American jurors. I agree with Justice Douglas that this idea that she lacks motivation was utter nonsense. I disagree with Ms. Heap that I didn't provide an adequate record. I was so dumbfounded. If you actually look at the transcripts, I actually turned to her, because thank God the transcripts or the bench conferences are transcribed. I said to her, did you mean to do that? I was so flabbergasted by the idea that you would do that to the last two African-American jurors. I said to her, did you mean to do that? Like, maybe there was a mistake here. You didn't mean to do that. So I tried to provide responses as best I could in the limited time we were given. I said that I didn't just say they were pretext. I said they're pretextual because youth isn't an issue in this case. I don't see how that has nothing to do, how her lack of art class, what that has to do with her motivation. And I said I discern no attitude in Ms. Reed's voice.
Was there another point, or have you covered your points?
I
think you mentioned two. I heard.
Yes, and the last one is I don't think the judge, in the third prong of Batson, actually did the proper analysis. I think what Judge Miley did was went back to, I don't think you've made a prima facie case, which by that point, it's already moved because the state had given them the reasons and I had alleged two separate minority veneermen.
Okay. Mr. Waters, Ms. Heap, thank you for your arguments here today, and the case will stand submitted.